Great documentary, terrible story.
I mean, really, really bad.
I had to watch it twice.
I mean,
I'm trying. It's true. Like, I'm okay.
Exactly. Am I right?
Oh, hi, Jillian Benzavalli.
Hello, Patrick Hines.
Hey, fam. We wanted to remind you, over there on the Patreon, we do drag bingo once a month, and our next drag bingo is going to be Friday, September 6th at 7 p.m. with the amazing Schwa.
The amazing Schwa.
Our friend Lindsay was at a party in Schwa's home city and was like, hey, do you know a drag queen named Schwa? And the guy goes, yeah, I married her.
Oh, my God. How amazing. Is that right?
That's
oh, my
true.
God.
Yeah, Lindsay texted me. I was like, oh, my God, you met Schwa's husband.
Oh, that's so funny. Isn't that wild? We love Schwa. Is like a professional across the board. It's so fun. Like, Schwa sings live. There's a performance. Oh, yep. She always looks beautiful.
Yep, the prizes are crazy. It's
and
so
like,
fun.
Runs bingo. Like, and I really mean, like, it's that's a hard gig to have. And yep. Schwa is like running that ship, and we have the best time.
It's so good. And the Patreon's great. It's where you get more Jillian and me. It's where we cover all of the long form series. So right now we're wrapping up Ashley Madison.
Yes.
We're doing Control Alt Desire next. I don't know anything about it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's another guy who's another piece of shit, another insecure man ruining it for everybody.
We did both seasons of The Jinx. You got to check out The Jinx Part 2. It is wild.
We did Quiet on Set. We did Love Has Won with Mother God.
Oh, God. The
with
Twin
no,
Flames.
No love to be found.
I know.
In Twin Flames or Love Has Won, actually.
It's really crazy. Like, I feel like all of the Patreon is great, but like in the last couple of months, we've had some really, really great ones.
Everyone is crazy. So we're sort of...
Put us out to work. Send me back to bartending.
I mean,
stop killing each other.
Happily.
Stop making calls. I will go right back to bartending.
I still make a mean vodka.
I know.
It's like riding a bike.
All right, girl. What are we talking about today?
Okay, so this is on Discovery Plus, but this is Broken Hearts. This is very highly requested. You and I had a conversation about it, and
yeah.
It's been out for a while, and yeah, here we go.
What caused a family to drive over a cliff to their death? That's the question multiple agencies from California to Washington are investigating.
This was not a normal traffic accident from the very onset, and it continued to be anything other than normal.
911, how can I help you?
Yeah, there's some kids that I feel is being highly abused.
You have two sets of children not tracking in terms of their normal development. Why do they all have the same condition?
Abigail, we mentioned her mom gave her an owie.
Devante, he was saying our moms, they're punishing us. They're depriving us of food.
Eventually, Jen and Sarah learned the obvious lesson, remove the children from school.
Jen seemed to be this super mom. This champion of racial reconciliation.
But in this case, when you start putting the totality of everything together, you know, something's rotten here.
How can we be so close to something so awful and not even know?
So we open, it's March 26, 2018. We're on Highway 1 in Mendocino, California. Sheriff Tom, who's with us throughout, he says there had been a call over the radio about, quote, a multi-fatality traffic accident.
Yeah. So a car a van had driven off the road and into the water. It's like a 75, 80-foot drop into the water.
Yeah.
And they say no guardrail, no protection. And I thought those same words apply to the kids.
Oh, my God.
They had no
guardrails,
no
protection. Leave
it
to you to think of, like, the brilliant metaphor.
I just thought of that. I was like, well, isn't that right?
It's
like, isn't
true.
That exactly why we're here? They had
no
fucking
guardrails,
protection.
No protection. I mean, and the thing about this area, this highway, it's absolutely stunningly beautiful. This is not an easy highway to drive off of. Yes, there are no guardrails, but like the overpass thing where they drove off is like a pull off. It's like, you know, 70 feet off the road.
It's deliberate.
It's deliberate, or else a majorly terrible accident has happened here.
Right.
And in the beginning, like, we all know it's deliberate, but like in the beginning, the authorities don't know that.
And everyone knows, like, this isn't normal. Like,
right.
something really awful happened.
And like, there's a lot of imagery. Like, we see pictures of this crumpled up SUV van upside down in the water. The waves are just like crashing over this thing. Like, obviously, whoever was in there, there are no survivors.
Yeah. So Cynthia Bartley is the evidence technician, and she says,
I was told that they had located two female adults within the passenger compartment of the vehicle, and they had located two male juveniles and a female juvenile outside on the rocks.
So far is what they found. And they find a Minnesota ID, and the name is Sarah Hart.
What did they do next?
They Google her.
They did some, quote, Google research.
They did Google research. And when they Google Sarah Hart, they find stories about Devante Hart.
Yeah.
And Devante went super, super viral. Now, just to be clear, and this is very important, all of the kids, there are six kids here, they're all black. So Devante is black. And he and his two siblings were adopted by the Hart family. And we'll get into all of the kids and where they come from very soon.
But if you don't know anything about this story, when you start to see these images of Devante and the family really in general, like as soon as the authorities Google that name, Sarah Hart, like the whole family stuff comes up.
Right.
And we're going to learn that the moms in this family, one in particular, the other one, Jennifer, were very, very online and doing that thing where they were like staging, like you talk about this all the time, like, you know, just manipulating their kids. It doesn't look like that at first. At first, it just looks like these beautiful, gorgeous pictures of these kids. But the internet is flooded with the internet is obsessed with this family.
And they're using their black children for content and for clout. So they're enormous racists.
Yeah.
Just to start. So the photo, this very, very famous photo is Devante hugging a white police officer at a rally in Portland, Oregon, supporting the protests of the shooting of Michael Brown.
Yeah.
So, and just immediately Devante's face, I'm like, there's so much pain in this poor little kid. Well, like, oh my God.
It's so interesting because I totally agree with you, but because he's hugging a police officer at a protest during the Black Lives Matter, the height of it all, it looks like a, quote, beautiful moment where Devante's having a really emotional moment and the police officer's having a real, but we're going to learn, like somebody says eventually, like this picture was not consensual. Devante, the child, didn't like, I mean, he's a very, very young kid in a very emotionally charged moment.
Right.
And we'll learn later, like being forced to do this shit by his fucking horrible parents.
And no one has ever helped him his whole life. And so he wants help and he's basically reaching out for help. And it also feels very, once you like know the full story and you're looking at these photos, it's very Kylie Jenner giving the cop a Pepsi or whatever the fuck, that horrifying commercial that way too many people thought was a good idea. And then the minute it aired, it was like, oh, not a black person in the room, huh? Seriously? Like nobody? Great, let's have Kylie Jenner like solve racism with a Pepsi. Like, I don't fucking think so.
Yeah.
Before I actually met the Harts, I heard about these kids that would come to these festivals that I attended. People mentioning like, oh, you know, the Hart kids, they give free hugs.
There's also a photo of him with a sign that says free hugs and like...
And that becomes like his calling card. Like that's what people... that's the other thing people know him for.
Am I really overreacting here that I don't like a kid with a free hug sign? You're inviting people to hug and touch you. Have I lost the plot here? I don't like
it. If Daisy came out of her room with a sign that she had made and it was her idea and she put it around her neck and we were going to a thing where I was going to be... I don't know. I think the sentiment of it is very sweet and kind. If it had been his idea, I think we know that it was absolutely not his idea.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Even if it was his idea.
Like, that's where the problem... I hear what you're saying.
I don't love it. And that it could totally be me overreacting.
No. I get it. Like, you don't want people to... We never really, other than that cop, see people actually hugging him.
But doesn't
you know?
It invite...
Yes.
And then it's sort of like... That whole idea, especially with little girls, where it's like, you don't have to hug someone just because you know that. You don't have to do any of that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm
going to go ahead and like revise my opinion. I'm not letting strangers hug my daughter.
You know...
But it's just the
They're using him.
Right. The point of this is to say, like, this sign wasn't his idea. It was all manipulation. It was all...
It's a great photo op. It's all for content and likes for them.
Yep.
So the Hart children are Sierra, Marcus, Abigail, Jeremiah, Devante, and Hannah.
Yeah.
And they were adopted by two lesbian women, Sarah and Jen. And it is very, again, incredibly important to note that none of the children they adopted were white. They are white. They're doing this white savior martyr complex thing and using and abusing these children.
You know, the kids are described by the talking heads, like people who knew the Hart family as like,
these kids were just pure joy. All they could do was just smile from ear to ear. They were always like propped up on people's shoulders, dancing in the crowd. The memories of that are so sweet. They were a unit.
They're talking about these rallies in Oregon that they would be seen at all the time.
Yeah.
And like, it reminded me of the one in California where the family, those kids were like chained to beds and kept inside all the time.
The Turpin family.
The Turpin family where like you would take the kids outside and they would just like know that they had to put on a show and they had, you know, because you see these videos and if you don't know the context, they do seem really happy. They do seem really sweet and loved by their parents.
Yeah.
But knowing the backstory makes it all the more tragic.
And it's also weird. It's like, did they go to the park ever or did they only go where there's media and cameras? Did they ever 100% do anything
media
that
cameras.
Was was like,
know.
Let's go to this, you know, what, I don't know, like the carnival down the street. Like,
right.
No, like all of the photos are like, look at this four-year-old at a fucking, you know, like endlessly.
Yeah.
That's all they do.
And if they did anything, quote, private, the mother, Jen, had the camera and was like staging photos.
It's all fake.
Yeah.
So March 27th, 2018, it's one day after the crash. Sarah and Jen Hart, the parents, have been identified, and three of the six deceased children. They say two were very young and one was late teens.
But they're also saying they know there's six kids. Like, where are the other three kids?
Right. And they're also like, they're from Washington State. There's a Minnesota ID. Why are they in California? There are just a lot of questions here. And why did this happen? Why and how did this happen?
Now we meet Cheryl, who was a coworker of Sarah's. They worked together at Kohl's, where Sarah was the assistant manager. And she's saying on Saturday, March 24th, 2018, so 2 days before the crash, Cheryl gets to work expecting her favorite manager, Sarah, is going to be like the cool overnight boss. Sarah's not there. It's somebody else.
I don't know if favorite, but she's like, Sarah seems to run a tight ship.
Uh-huh.
So Cheryl's like, if Sarah's not here.
I don't know. I think Sarah's very much under Jen's thumb.
Mm.
And I think
she has a good mask. Sarah, she's pretty like.
And I think that when she's away from Jen, maybe she's happy. You know what I mean? Like
well,
when she used to be at work.
I hear you. Yeah. Because Sarah had texted at 3 a.m. that she was really, really sick and she couldn't come in. She might have had to go to the hospital. It's one of those 3 a.m.
And this is Friday. So by Sunday, nobody's heard from her. Nobody knows where she is. She's, quote, a very dependable person. Cheryl sends her another text like, girl, let us know that you're okay. Like, everyone's worried about you. Like, what is going on? And it was just radio silence.
And then Monday, Sarah still isn't at work. And Cheryl says, enough is enough. She calls 911 for a welfare check.
Yeah.
Just to paint this picture, your coworker is missing Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. She's not there. You call for a welfare check. 10 minutes later, the cops call back Cheryl and they're like, hey.
We got some questions for you, girl.
And he says, well, how many children does she have? And I said, she has six. He asked if I knew anything about her not feeding her children. And that kind of threw me for a loop. And I said, I don't know anything about that.
No, I don't know anything about that. I'm calling because I got this weird text from her and then I haven't seen her in 3 days. I don't know anything about anything, but what is going on
over at
that
house?
Yeah,
can you just go to the house and check on them? And they're like, we don't have to go. We've already been there today because they got a call from the Department of Health and Social Services who were also called to go like do a welfare check. And we'll get the story to that as to why they were called later.
Yeah.
But they're like, they're gone.
They
like,
packed their stuff and they left.
And there's nobody there.
So, okay. So now we're back to the day after the crash and the cops need to find those three missing children.
Yeah.
Because the cops realize now that the day before this crash, there were not one, but two welfare checks at the house because one was Cheryl saying Sarah's missing from work and the other was CPS who had made all of these previous attempts to try to contact the family.
Yeah.
So the cops go to the house. They say they don't find anything out of the ordinary, but this reminded me of the Turpin family too because it's like tons of food in the fridge.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't mean the kids are being fed though.
Right. And like bowls of fruit on the table. And they say that like, because the cops are going in response to the idea that the kids aren't being fed.
Right.
And we'll get that story from the neighbor in a minute, but that's what the cops are there to check out. And they're like, I don't know. It looks like there's plenty of food in the house. And like, it's just interesting that people are not trained to ask the next question.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like the neighbor is saying the kids are complaining that they're not being fed. There's tons of food in the house. The cops are like, the kids must be lying or whatever, but they're not thinking like, no, there are instances in which like parents starve their children or parents abuse their children by not giving them food.
Right. Or the food becomes currency or they're like dangling the food in front of them and it's a punishment or whatever.
Right.
So we're going to South Dakota to talk to some family members and we meet Jen's aunt. So Jen's aunt, who recently saw them, lives in South Dakota and she's the one who has the most contact with the children, like through the family.
But also like hasn't spoken to them in years, which I thought was notable that like you have six kids, you have an aunt that you used to be close with, but you're not anymore. We were talking about this off mic. Neither Jen nor Sarah's family is in this documentary at all.
Uh-huh.
And it feels like they ran screaming from this family years before everything was at least brought to the surface and we knew that it went bad.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was interesting that like the only contact Jen has is with this aunt and she hasn't talked to her in years.
Right.
You know?
And I mean, I think it shows that they've been terrible people. I don't know necessarily if the family knew about the abuse and did nothing.
We don't know
the context of that.
Yeah.
So
it just seems like when you have six kids, you're the kind of people who like your family. You know what I mean? And they're lesbians. So maybe that played in a part of why we don't get any of their backstory at all.
But this aunt was able to positively ID the children at the scene of the crash. So she identifies Marcus, Jeremiah, and Abigail. And the cops say that all of the children were in the car, but the three that are missing, the bodies that are missing, are Sierra, Hannah, and Devante.
Yeah, they're just at such a loss. And the cops put out a press release like just saying, like, we're looking for these three missing kids. Do you know anything? Can anybody tell us anything?
And so Jackie, this reporter from Portland, Oregon,
I love her,
gets wind of the story.
Anytime a whole family is killed in a crash, it's a huge news story. But then the photographer that I worked with back in 2016 ran into the newsroom and said, Jackie, we interviewed them at the Bernie Sanders rally.
They were that big family at the Bernie Sanders rally.
And we see the footage. Because you have to understand, the story of the van going over the cliff is everywhere. And nobody knows why this happened. Nobody's even thinking about it in terms of a murder at this point.
How did this tragic accident happen? They lost control of the car.
This tragic accident to this family that's based on love and these beautiful kids. And, like, they were doing so much great stuff for the world. And, oh my God. So, like, the family is, like, kind of famous very quickly. And Jackie's realizing that, like, they interviewed them, like you said, at the Bernie Sanders
because
rally.
Because Devante is there because he'd gone viral with his free hug sign.
Yes.
And they're all wearing Heartburn shirts, like Heart, H-A-R-T,
and Bernie.
But Jen is on the news. Like, she's being interviewed about her family.
Yes.
And so reporters go to the house, and when they go to the house, they discover the CPS card in the door. So they go, what the fuck? They go to the neighbors, and the neighbors are like, oh yeah, we're the ones who called CPS.
Yes.
Now, these neighbors now tell the reporters the kids were coming over and begging them for food and say, this is going to break your fucking heart.
Yeah.
The kids are saying, can you just hide it by the fence? Because, like, I'll come get it when she's not looking. Yeah. And we're like, which one is she? Who's the mean one? We'll get there in a minute.
Non-perishable food.
Like, these women were withholding food from their children as a form of punishment. And that's what we hear.
What can't be overstated here is what, like, the world is learning that this beautiful family full of love and these six adopted kids are dead. But these reporters from, like, this small news station in Oregon are the first to be like, wait a second. Like, there's more to the story here because there's a CPS card at the door and now the neighbors are saying the kids have been... So like,
and they're just gone.
Right.
Like,
so
what?
This story has not broken yet. The only story that's out there right now is like the beautiful family that's at the bottom of this cliff.
Right. And the first thing they learn is this horribly abusive behavior that's going on at the house. These kids are begging for food. And also, it has to be a secret because they'll get in trouble if they're eating. Oh my God.
And this is where Jackie, the reporter, is like going through the social media. And she's just like, I don't understand. Like, these pictures are so beautiful and they look like they could be in a magazine. And, you know, the kids look so happy and the parents look so happy. Like, what is really going on here?
So we're at the investigation of the car accident. And this falls under the jurisdiction of the California Highway Patrol. And so they're doing a forensic investigation on the vehicle, as they say. So here's what they find. And this is all really important.
There were no skid marks at all. Also, according to the Highway Patrol, there was no indication of seatbelt use, and it was determined that there was no braking, and the speedometer was pegged and locked at around 90 miles an hour.
The car didn't skid out of control, because the first thing is she lost control of the wheel. Something tragic happened for this to go down this way. No. The car didn't skid at all. And there's no indication of seatbelt use, they say.
That is the craziest thing.
And they say also, no brakes were used. And they were able to determine that the speedometer was pegged and locked at around 90 miles per hour. And the more they learn, it becomes very clear that this was all planned.
Right.
And they rigged the car to drive off this cliff at 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, they say the car had stopped 70 feet from the cliff's edge. Like, it was at a dead stop and then accelerated and just went straight over.
And because of that, now it's murder.
Right.
Like, this is where we are now.
Exactly.
And so April 4th, 2018, 9 days after the crash, we meet Zarin Burnett, and he's a journalist, and he's awesome, and he is going to lay it all out for us in a very honest way.
Yeah, because he learned about this story on Twitter, because he was saying, I bet a lot of journalists at least used to do this, where he was saying you could go on Twitter and find, like, stories before they became national news.
And he's like, all the black women that I followed were talking about Devante Hart, the kid from the Ferguson protests.
Yes.
So he says, I'm going to be honest with you right from the beginning. And Zarin is black. I'm just saying that. Because he's talking a lot about his experience here.
And that's important. That's one of the reasons why he's so emotional about the story.
Yeah. So he's like, I'm going to be really honest with you. Two white women adopting six black kids is already very suspicious.
Yeah.
But it's way worse than he ever could have imagined. Let's go back to 2006, and we meet Dr. Raquel Warley. She's an associate professor of social work, and she tells us about the first three children to come to the family.
Yeah.
Marcus, Hannah, and Abigail, and they're all siblings.
Right. And she says, you know, they were very young. They came from, quote, poor backgrounds. Marcus was 5, Hannah was 2, Abigail was 6 months old.
Yeah.
The biological mother had issues, and the biological mother gave up the kids intentionally. She terminated her own parental rights to put the kids into the adoption foster care system to give them a better chance.
And they say they weren't getting the medical care they needed.
Yeah.
So Jen and Sarah, the two fucking monsters, adopted through a place called the Permanent Family Resource Center, which is out of Minnesota.
Yeah.
But they said all the right things. They're like, oh, there's three of them? Absolutely. We'll take all three young children. I know they have work to do. I know they have medical expenses. You know, we'll get all the therapy. They said everything right.
And the fact that they wanted to keep the kids together, that's like the most important thing. The foster care system and the adoption, like, they all are looking for that. Nobody wants to split up the kids.
And their CPS caseworkers, like,
they took them for a speech therapy and kept up with their medication regimen.
Approximately a year later, I had to take three more kids to Minnesota. So I check in on Marcus and Hannah and Abby, and the difference was amazing.
All three of them were thriving. They were getting the speech therapy. They were getting the medicine they needed, which we don't go into detail about. But, like, they were being cared for, so it seems.
Right. And my question is just, like, where did this all go so wrong? Or was it going so wrong from the minute the kids were placed there?
And they turn it on for CPS when they come over.
Yeah, exactly.
So 2 years after that and 10 years before the crash, it's 2008, and they are approved to adopt Devante, Jeremiah, and Sierra.
Yeah.
Now, while they are in that process of adopting Devante, Jeremiah, and Sierra, there's an allegation about violently disciplining the three siblings they already have. So Hannah is 2 years old.
Yes.
And Hannah makes a report in school. I'm sorry, everyone. This is going to be very, very hard, and I apologize. Hannah makes a report in school that she's being hit with a belt, and she has the bruises to show for it.
Yeah, and like Jen and Sarah both deny having any knowledge of how the bruises got on her body, and they say child welfare investigated, but there, quote, wasn't enough evidence to indicate that that had happened.
Do you mean other than the bruises in Hannah's statements?
And that's like, you know what I mean? So once again, when Steve and I were going through the foster care system, I was saying this to you off mic, we had cats that we got rid of because our cat, by got rid of, I mean we found a loving home for her, like hissed at Daisy one time and we were afraid the cat was going to scratch her and that scratch on Daisy's body could result in Daisy being taken away from us.
Yeah.
So, like, this whole idea that while they're in the process of adopting these other three kids, like, even just being accused of this thing that they clearly, obviously did do should have been enough for them not to have been able to take these other three kids.
Well, and I think that's what a lot of the journalists of color here are saying. It's like the power
of
the white women and all of their kids are black, and it becomes the black kid's word against the white woman's word.
Yeah.
And, like, lucky for the white women.
Well, and Zeranes even says at one point, Jen denies what they're being accused of. And he says that's her power as a white woman. Yeah. She says something and people believe it.
So 2 years after that, the bruises that Hannah has.
Yeah.
2 years later, it's 2010. Abigail tells a teacher about the abuse.
She mentioned to her teacher that her mom gave her an owie. And she pulled up her shirt and her teacher saw bruises on her stomach.
Based on the CPS reports, there are bruises indeed by her belly button, but then also on her back and up by her sternum.
So there were bruises all over Abigail's body, on her stomach, on her back, on her chest, like her sternum. And apparently, this happened because Abigail had a penny in her pocket.
Make it make sense.
Well, it's just power and control and abuse. I mean, this is like complete 101, right? So Abigail said Jen, remember this, this is a little complicated, but it's important. Abigail says Jen was the one who beat her, but the cops arrest Sarah. Now, Sarah pleads guilty to domestic assault. Sarah admits
she volunteers as tribute.
Yeah, her anger got the best of me. I never hit my kids before, but I was totally out of my rope with Abigail. How many times do we have to tell her about the penny in her pockets? Like, it's so fucking stupid.
Yeah.
But Sarah falls on her sword, and Sarah says, well, the reason Abigail has these bruises is because I bent Abigail over the tub, which is why she is bruised on her sternum and her stomach, and spanked her.
I'm sorry, they're punching these children.
They're like shoving them. And they're little. I mean, a little.
Yes. And they're doing it in places where they think nobody will see the bruising.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Until the kids start to talk.
Right.
Now, the running theory is that Sarah is covering for Jen, and that Jen is the ringleader and super mean and very abusive, and that Sarah is definitely complicit, but Sarah is also being abused by Jen.
Right.
And is sort of like a buffer for the kids, but Sarah is definitely part of this, but she's she's taking the fall for Jen, and Jen is the ultimate ringleader here.
And we get the on-screen text that on April 7th, Sarah Hart pleads guilty to misdemeanor domestic assault and is sentenced to 1 year of probation and community service. Now, think about that. She admits to beating her kid. She gets convicted of it, and she gets nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She gets probation and community service, and then the charge of malicious punishment of a child is dropped.
Now, this is going to blow your mind even more. Between November 2010 and January 2011, there were 6 calls made to CPS. That is 6 calls to CPS in 3 months.
Yeah.
Now, Sarah was convicted, and still there was not enough information or evidence to actually do something to help the kids. And what I'm thinking is like, fuck, well, now aren't the kids bigger targets now?
Yes.
Because they told on their moms?
Or I don't know if it was that, because we do find out that like Jen's own friends are turning her into CPS.
The neighbors
are calling.
But to me, I'm more scared for the kids.
Well,
it's
because
like,
it's telling the kids that no one's going to save you. It's telling the kids that no matter what, this is your life.
And now they're mad.
Yeah.
Like now the moms have to be mad. Like now there's the kids have a bigger target on their back.
And also, Zarin, the journalist, points out...
Eventually, Jen and Sarah seem to notice that if they can minimize the children's contact with other adults, then nobody would be able to file reports with CPS. Nobody would be able to involve police officers coming to the house unannounced to check on their children. So they learn the obvious lesson. Remove the children from school.
They rip them out of school.
Right. Thank you. Amazing job, everybody. Thank you so much. So let's go back. Now, we're jumping around with the timeline.
We aren't. The documentary
The documentary
is.
Yeah. So 2 weeks after the crash, the cops find Sierra Hart's body, which confirms that the bodies of Hannah and Devante are also in the water.
Yeah.
So now we meet Shonda Jones, who's a lawyer, and she represents the biological aunt of Devante, Jeremiah, and Sierra, because remember, they're all siblings, and they were the second 3 children to be adopted.
The second set of kids, yeah. And Shonda, the attorney, kept the paperwork on this case like at hand in her office for 7 years because she thought what happened here was such an injustice.
Yeah.
So this is a crazy story. And Shonda was saying, like, remember, 7 years ago, she lost her case, and she now is hearing about these kids in the van that went over the cliff, and she said, they said Devante, Harris County, and Minneapolis, and she's like, that's my case.
Yeah.
The case that I've kept at my fingertips for the last 7 years, this is it. I knew something was fucked up about this.
Right.
So Shonda was representing Priscilla Celestine, who was a paternal aunt of Devante, Jeremiah, and Sierra. Shonda says she became furious and she wanted people to know that there was another backstory here, that this like fate that happened to these kids did not have to be what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so we learned that the biological mother of those 3 kids had what is described as, quote, a drug problem. And the state of Texas was looking to terminate the mother's parental rights as well as the father. And the father's sister, Priscilla, stepped in because she wanted the kids to stay in the family. In the foster care system, this happens all the time.
Yeah.
And it is preferred. And the state of Texas has a law on the books that, like, during the entire case, while these kids are in the system in any way, they should always be looking for somebody in the family to take the kids.
And Priscilla's lawyer is like, Priscilla was awesome. She was already taking very good care of the children. This would be great for them. Really wouldn't change up their routine. Like, let's keep their lives as, like, normal, quote, as possible. Like, this is, Priscilla's a great candidate for these
kids. She is. Now, I wrote this down for verbatim, and I want to talk about exactly what is said here, because we learned that one day while Priscilla, the caretaker, the aunt, was at work,
the daughter allowed their biological mother to come in and visit with the children, and the child welfare worker showed up. They felt like this was a violation. It put the children at risk, and that it was such a safety issue that they had to remove the children from that home immediately.
They had to remove the children from the home immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So the crime that was committed here was that the biological mother was allowed to come into the home and visit with the children without a social worker,
unattended.
And these visits are usually either, so if the mother had lost the right to visit the children, she would not be allowed to see them. In our circumstance, the birth mother was allowed to see Daisy under supervised circumstances at the adoption agency. That's how those visitation works.
Okay.
And I will tell you that the system takes this shit very seriously.
Okay.
So there was a major violation here.
Okay, so I actually looked this up because it doesn't make sense. It's not clear in this documentary, right?
Oh, good. Tell me what you find.
There's a lot here. So this is mostly from the Texas Tribune and Associated Press and a couple of other sources. But the siblings were all in foster care at different houses before they came to Priscilla.
Uh-huh.
There's also a 4th older sibling named Dante that Sarah and Jen were, quote, not interested in taking. Probably because he was too old to manipulate, honestly.
Not interested. And one of the reasons that they all went to them was because they were, quote, keeping the siblings together.
I know. These people are fucking monsters.
Oh my God.
So there were like 7 people under one roof for Priscilla, and she was in a kinship placement, which means that she didn't qualify for any stipends or anything.
But and also, they don't have to be, at least in New York, those people don't have to be pre-cleared. If you're family, you can get the kids and then do the like the getting cleared on the back end. You do have to be cleared eventually, but they will send them to you before that.
Right. So in this case, though, like money was super tight. She had all of these people to feed, new beds for the kids, increased grocery bills. And on
Are you saying because she was, it's a kinship placement, she didn't get any money for the kids?
She didn't qualify. In Texas, she wasn't qualifying for help.
Yeah, because in foster care, they give you money to take care of the kids.
Yeah, she got a certain amount and then that's it. She wasn't given stipends on like a regular basis. Okay. So now that's 4 kids plus her daughter plus her granddaughter. It's like a lot of mouths to feed, a lot of clothes, school supplies, diapers. Plus she had to move. So she was first in a 2-bedroom apartment and then they said, nope, that's not enough. Like she wasn't going to get cleared for the placement until she moved. So because of this, she had to work more hours. And now usually her daughter was taking care of the kids while she worked. But sometimes her daughter wasn't able to watch the kids. And that's when their mother, Sherry, who gave up parental rights, would sometimes help out. But unfortunately, it was a condition of the children living with Priscilla that Sherry is not allowed to be left alone with them because she had given up her rights. But because she, like, Priscilla's like, well, you wanted me to have this big apartment and like take care of all these kids and they need diapers. Like, I don't know what to do. So like one of those times when Sherry, the birth mother, was watching her kids, that's when CPS did their like surprise visit.
Yep.
And so there are like some sources saying that Priscilla asked Sherry to come visit, and some say that Priscilla's daughter, that it was her daughter that let them into the house. So that's not very clear, but like Sherry, the birth mom, like let CPS in. She's like, I'm a family friend. I sleep over sometimes. Like it was just a lot of shitty things happening at once.
Yes.
And then like just like a lot of victim of circumstances situation. And it was just like,
it's just crazy. It's like there's just no help for these families that are trying to keep the family together. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And imagine, like, I don't know.
It's a mess. It's a mess.
It is absolutely.
And there was like no help. Like, we've just been saying, like, there's no help for Priscilla, who's like really wanting to keep these kids together and take care of them. And then, like, she was sort of like left in the situation.
God, well, thanks for the side, good
no
girl.
No problem.
Jesus.
Sorry, everybody. Priscilla fought for the kids, though, because she was like, they're still safer with me. Like, please don't put them in the system.
Yeah.
She was denied the children. The children are put into the system and then also allowed to be adopted by the Harts,
who CPS
is fucking being called on them every other week. So, like, what is going on here?
What I want to be really clear. I'm not advocating that the kids should have been removed from Priscilla. I think, like, in our circumstance, if something like that had happened with us, I imagine that we would have been given a second chance, or I don't know that for sure. I think there needs to be a lot of gray here. I think, obviously the kids, they want the kids to stay with the family, and that is optimal, and Priscilla was a great caretaker. It does seem insane that the kids would just be ripped away from her without any opportunity, because Shonda, the attorney, will eventually say, it feels like what happened was predetermined.
Well, they were just, like, ripped from their family and given to the 2 white women.
Yes.
Like, hello?
Right. And Shonda, the attorney, says it feels like that was predetermined, and no matter what, that's what was going to happen.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? And so Zarin, the journalist that we've been talking about, he's out of his mind over this. That, like, they were ripped away from the family member that was taking care of them and given to the white women who abused and then murdered them.
Right. It's like when I was talking to Connie Walker on Let the Women. Like, they were doing this in this country with indigenous families all the time.
Yes.
Like, putting the kids in the paper because they'd be better off with the white families.
Yeah.
Like, this is not a new phenomenon.
Yeah.
This happens in this country on a regular basis. And, like, now we're here.
I know. I agree.
3 weeks after the crash, the toxicology results come back, and Jennifer Hart's blood alcohol content was 0.102. The legal limit is 0.08.
Oh,
so,
wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So this is extra weird, we hear, because she didn't really drink. She barely drank.
Yeah.
But Sarah and all the children had Benadryl in their system.
Like, they say a significant amount of Benadryl.
So basically, these are 2 family annihilators. But if you're looking for any kind of, like, I don't even want to use the term silver lining because that seems too much. But these kids were completely knocked out and unconscious. They had drugged them
so
that they didn't know what was going on, put them in the car, got hammered.
Undid their seatbelts. Which, I mean, it's all just so crazy and awful, but that just feels so, I don't know what the word for that is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Disgusting. Yeah. I mean, but the science is saying that these kids went to sleep.
Yeah.
And that's like they weren't sitting in the car terrified going over that cliff is what we're told.
But the other thing that's significant about this is it shows the level of premeditation it wasn't in the moment, because I had always imagined the story that like Sarah's asleep in the passenger seat, the kids are asleep in the back, Jen sees the cliff, sees an opportunity and just went for it.
Yeah.
And that is not the case. Like Sarah was very in on it. It seems like it was a plan the whole time. They said they would have had to have drugged those kids 2 hours prior. Mm-hmm. So like this was always the plan.
Well, CPS was being called on them every other week to begin with, and then they saw the walls closing in and said like let's do it. I mean, they saw this coming for years.
Yeah.
So 1 month after the crash, the public starts learning about all the reports of abuse, and everything was both documented and ignored.
Yeah.
So for example, in 2013, they have all six kids with them at this point. 2013. Now Jen has been convicted. Like, this is years after well-documented abuse. Jen and the kids are staying with some friends.
Yeah.
Six kids, 8, 10, 12 kids are at a sleepover. They order pizza, right?
Yeah.
Jen was only letting her six kids have like half a slice each. Now, one of their kids snuck down in the middle of the night to eat more pizza. The next morning, Jen realizes the pizza is gone, which means that she's like counting the slices to make sure that no one had more.
She woke up to have a morning slice because she's like making sure that she's well fed.
But she went to bed doing inventory to make sure no one was going to get one over on her and have another bite of sustenance. So Jen notices, oh my God, someone broke the rules and ate more fucking pizza. Jen immediately gets violent.
A friend reported that she dragged one of the kids, and Jen had all six kids lay down on an inflated air mattress with sleep mask on their faces and their arms by their side for 5 hours.
And makes them lay there like totally straight with sleep masks on their faces and their arms at their sides for 5 hours.
And then when the friend brings it up to her, like, girl, this is crazy. What are you doing? Jen said she didn't see what she was doing was extreme.
Now, if she's doing that in public, what is she doing
in private? If she's doing that in front of her friend, what is she doing behind closed doors at home?
And like, what do you do when you're that friend?
Well, she calls CPS.
I mean, so, like,
you know what I mean? Like in that moment, I really don't know what you do.
You have to do something.
I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to put myself in that position. I mean, I think hopefully she went and called CPS like that very day.
Yes. It's just like the abuse, like when you really think about, because food is such an easy thing to control with kids.
Yes.
And it's not just the control. Like when you think about the physical abuse, like kids need food for their physical development, their mental development.
Yes.
Like it's psychological, emotional, mental, physical abuse to withhold food and use it as currency and punishment.
Yeah.
Like kids need to eat to grow.
It's so evil. It's so evil. And like, what was it like at that friend's house for the rest of the time? Like, were the friend's kids just having four slices of pizza and these kids are giving? And
probably. Also, they had to watch the other kids eat.
Look at these pictures of these kids, the quote, beautiful pictures that you see on Facebook. They are so skinny. These kids are so emaciated. Yeah. But like, Jen isn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's clearly eating just fine.
Well, we learned Jen would be nice when she wanted photos for the internet and then mean every other second of the day. And this is all based on documents that and things that the kids told their teachers or neighbors.
Yeah.
That like, the kids are constantly walking on eggshells. The kids were, quote, trained like robots. And so when we see this all the time, like when CPS comes to question the kids, they deny the abuse, which is like, there's got to be a better way here.
Because CPS handles this so fucking badly, because they interview the kids at the house with the parents just out of earshot.
Watching them.
Of course they're going to, like, the thing that I kept saying all along was like, these systems are so underfunded, right? When we were in the foster care system, we had like three different case managers in the 2 years that we had Daisy, because they make no money. They are so overworked. Our case manager had like 32 other cases. One kid died in the foster care system because we need more eyes on this. You know what I mean? We need more. We also need more families in these situations. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a lot of times kids get left in not ideal situations because there literally are not enough families to take kids in.
But the things, the parameters that we have in place need to be better to begin with.
Yes.
Like the stuff that they're doing also isn't working.
Right.
So on top of all this stuff that's needed, can we fix what we're able to do?
But you know what? What it also really is, and I know you've said this in another way, it really is the built-in racism in the system, because I do think, you know, a caseworker comes to the home of these two, like this cute married lesbian white couple, and they think, oh, we don't need to interview the kids. There's no way these two ladies are abusing these children.
Well, I'm going to make a comparison here, and it might sound like a leap, but it's not.
Yeah.
John Wayne Gacy did the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Like being in politics, being photographed, being like, you know, rubbing elbows with powerful people. Like that's Devante from the Ferguson protest.
Yeah.
That's this family that so obviously wants change. How uh-huh. can they be racist? Uh-huh. It's like they're super racist.
Yeah.
So like when CPS comes and the kids are like, no, everything is fine. Jen and Sarah are blaming the kids. Oh, our kids have food issues. They come from bad families. They come from this, blah, blah, blah. So this is yeah. when Zarin says, well, Jen is a white woman, can say anything she wants about these black kids, and she's believed. Because when they go to the doctor,
yeah.
because eventually CPS is like, well, can you take them to the doctor at least? Because like we're getting all these calls. Five, like right. the doctor is like their family doctor.
Yeah.
And five out of the six kids were underweight, but still totally normal and healthy.
And under height. So like that's the
other
thing.
That's what I mean, the development.
And it really is like you see what you want to see, and that's the training we have to untrain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The doctor doesn't want to believe that these women are abusing the kids, that they're withholding food.
Well, we gotta face it, everybody. Too bad.
Zarin, the journalist, says,
you have two sets of children. The two groups are not biologically related, and yet they all have the same conditions of not being on the growth charts, not tracking in terms of their normal development. Why do they all have the same condition?
They all have the exact same problem. They're all underweight and all under height except for one. Why is nobody asking a question?
Right.
If you have six children, one or two maybe are underweight, under height, whatever. I guess that's fine. Five of the six children are basically sickly.
Yeah.
And then the doctor signs off. He's like, I see absolutely nothing wrong
and
here.
And I'm sure that sixth one was right under the wire.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was a quarter of a pound yeah. that made it. Oh, no, this one's fine. You know what I mean? It's all
right.
bullshit.
And it's like, how many different systems and how many different actual professionals failed these kids? Because every single one of them wanted to not believe yeah. that these white lesbians could be abusing these kids.
I loved Zarin's point about like, yeah, but say they're not like, they're from two different homes.
Yes.
They're not biologically
yes.
like what? And also if five out of six were underweight and under malnourished, then, but they were still quote normal, healthy children. No, five
no.
out of six
exactly.
makes it not normal and makes it unhealthy.
You know, and the thing is, they talk about Marcus, the oldest one, I believe, who had like a very strong jawline. There's something wrong. Like you look at his face and he looks malnourished.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like he's starving, you
yeah.
know? And these kids, of course, are trained to answer the questions like the right way.
Yeah.
But like, we know, CPS worker, if you're going to take the time and go to the trouble to go to the house and question the kids about abuse, do it in a way where we know they might give you an honest answer.
Mm-hmm.
Get
That's
them
what I'm
out
saying.
Of the house, separate them from everybody else, put them in a safe place, make them feel comfortable.
Right, that's what I mean. Like, if we can't throw all the money that's needed at it, can we at least fix the system that we have in place a little bit
exactly.
to make it so that they can be protected
yeah.
instead of just, like, being asked a question under their fucking watchful eye of their abusive parents?
Exactly, especially when we know what that produces,
yeah.
you know?
So Oregon CPS is investigating these abuse allegations, and while that's happening, all the kids get to stay at the house,
yeah.
and the Hart family becomes, quote, a fixture in the Portland community, going to all these spiritual events and political events, and we learn Jen was, like, the commanding officer and staging all of this.
And we see a lot of it. We see a lot of, like, video footage, and we see a lot of photographs.
Yeah. And so their entire online presence was very, very curated, and Dr. Joni Johnston is here, and she is a clinical and forensic psychologist, and I just want to say, I really want to slow down on what she says here.
Yeah.
She says everything was very curated. And she says we can tell a lot about a family or a person based on the way they use social media.
How often they use it to get their emotional needs met. How often do they interact with other people? What kind of pictures do they post? It tells us a lot about their values and the things that are important to them.
How do they use it to interact with people to get praise?
Yeah.
What kind of pictures do they post? What kind of life are they presenting? And if all of this is different than what reality is, it really tells us a lot about their values and what's important to them.
Yeah.
And she's like, you can tell in 2 seconds something isn't right.
Right.
Something is not right here.
But you know what? Most people aren't even looking at these pictures for 2 seconds. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
They're scrolling through. Oh, what a cute kid. Oh, what a sweet image. Oh, that's a stunning photo to look at.
Yeah.
But if you pull the curtain back a little bit, because Dr. Johnson also says, these are people who didn't have a lot of friends. They didn't invite people over to the house.
No.
They presented everything
they
online. Right. But that's what I mean. It's
yeah.
like, look a little bit deeper and realize that, like, when they're presenting only one image online, you know what I mean? Like, that is something, especially when children are involved, that is something to question.
It's a very curated narrative.
Yeah.
And at the focus of this narrative and social media content is Devante.
Yeah.
Because Devante, just undeniably, a very special kid. People responded to him. But they're, like, Jen and Sarah are like, oh, he's a perfect perfect shield.
Yeah.
They're using him as a shield because so many of the posts were about how Devante was saved by them. Like, literally laying in fall leaves with a sign that says thank you on it.
Yeah.
And they would post these fake stories for clicks about Devante encountering racism, and this old man in the checkout line was harassing Devante. And Devante, this is when Zarin Burnett is reading the
post. I know, yeah.
And there's one line where Jen's like, I let him step into his own power. And Zarin stops and he's like, that statement is gaggingly offensive. But anyway.
Gaggingly offensive. I was like, wait a second.
I digress.
Hi, Zarin.
Yeah, like, I loved it. But it's true. And everything is about, and I'm like, it's so fake. Of course it goes viral. But like, this shit doesn't happen. Like,
yeah.
When you see a post like this, and when,
you
I mean,
should be offended by it because it's so obviously fucking fake.
But also, yeah, not only should you be offended by it, but also I think I'm like extra triggered because of those stupid family vloggers from Ashley Madison.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Like, this isn't what happens when someone like overhears a conversation.
Right.
And then
yeah.
Suddenly can write 5 pages of prose
yeah.
with direct quotes. It's fake.
But
if you see, that's not how memory works. So for Sarah to even write that with perfectly written dialogue,
yeah.
Oh my God, I overheard this thing in the restaurant. I overheard this thing. That is fake.
And it's also like, it's so blatantly using Devante's race but it's so obvious. I don't know. Like, I can't imagine if I had read that, I would have believed that story. You know what I mean?
But a lot of white people
I know.
Really need that shit to
yeah.
feel good about themselves.
Yeah.
And a lot of white people.
Because it ends with Devante being like, I'm going to be, because they're saying you're going to be a ball player when you grow up. I've never seen anyone who looks like you who doesn't end up being
right.
a bat. You know, it's all the racist tropes. And so it ends with Devante being like,
man, well, what do you want to be when you grow up, son?
I'm here to help people. I'm here to inspire now.
Man said, what are you going to do to help and inspire people?
Son, I'm going to be myself. No matter how much people try to make me something I am not,
have
a great
night.
Flash's ginormous smile.
I'm going to be whoever I want to be, no matter what kind of box people try to put me in.
But, like, this was so obviously written by a basic white bitch.
Yes.
Do you know what
yes,
I mean? Like,
exactly.
Like, this didn't happen.
No.
So when you are online, dear listener, and you're seeing these things, like, those stupid family vloggers and Ashley Madison did it, too. It's like, when you see, like, let me tell you about what happened today, and it's
yeah.
a 5-page perfectly written piece of fiction.
Yes. Because don't you feel manipulated? Like, you're using his race to make me feel something, and that should really fucking offend you.
Well,
you know,
they're using him because, like, you know, Jen would talk about Devante's childhood before he was adopted, about,
yeah.
you know, her words. He's surrounded by drugs. He was surrounded by guns. He was being shot at. And, like,
yeah.
it's all a lie, right? Like,
right.
it was a life of little hope and a future that seemed over before it began. Like, girl.
And it was like, that's the article in the Huffington Post that was inspired by this Facebook post. And, like, Shonda, the attorney for the woman who had these kids taken away from her, were like, nobody fact checked this. These
nobody.
Are all facts that Jen told the reporter that the reporter then regurgitated as though what is truth. She's like, find anybody in Houston, find any police report anywhere that talks about Devante trying alcohol, Devante being shot
it's
at.
A lie.
Yeah. Devante coming to them only knowing the words shit and fuck. It's all a lie.
It's a lie. And so, like, it's also not really about Devante at all.
Exactly.
Because it's about Jen, and it's all about look what we did for him. And so that's when Zarin says, his one-liners.
It's so good.
They're amazing. Because he says,
she's using Facebook just like an advertiser or a marketer, and she's selling white saviorhood, but she doesn't care about the kids. She just wants the likes and the dopamine hit. She's hurting all of these people for that.
She doesn't care about the kids. She only cares about the attention that they get her.
Yeah. So we take a little bit of a left turn here because we do talk about family annihilators, which you never think of as women. You know what I mean?
Well, get used to it, everybody.
Get used to it. And this Dr. Johnson woman is saying that, like, family annihilation is the most common form of mass murder.
Holy shit.
That took my breath away.
I mean.
And she said, but it's an incredibly difficult event to predict because it's so rare. And she said there's, like, no one profile of the family annihilator, but there are some commonalities. So history of undiagnosed depression, people who have a strong need for status and attention.
Yep. And, it, like, if you're not my friend, you're my enemy.
Yeah.
Like, if things aren't good, then they're awful, you
yes.
know? Like, and they almost always have what she calls an environmental trigger.
Well, and so in this case, it all culminates on that Friday. Remember, Sarah called into work, and we're going to
yeah.
find out it's because the neighbors called CPS.
They're caught.
Right. They're
That's,
caught.
They're caught. They're,
exactly.
Their narrative, this perfect, this white savior martyr victim complex
yeah.
is about to be shattered, and they can't handle it.
The thing is, there is something to be learned here, because it's like, if we ever see another family that is so obviously using living their kids. Like, if you see a family that is posting so much on social media, but they have no actual friends, they have nobody who's actually seeing their life, but you see them using their children to sort of present this perfect image that's actually getting the world to talk about them, watch that family. They're the ones that you have to be like, a triggering event. These kids are in danger.
In danger.
You know?
And also, like, the racism can't be ignored, because Jen wanted to present herself as someone who's, like, at the forefront of protest culture, like, super performative. And that photo of Devante hugging the cop was perfect for her and what she wanted.
Yeah.
Now, for, like, a lot of white people, they were like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Now, we hear, like, the
They're here now saying it.
Right.
They're saying it now, how beautiful and amazing. And Devante's going to be a change agent and, mm-hmm. oh, my God.
And, like, the non-white people in the room were like, yeah, no, this was weird.
Yes.
This was weird from the beginning.
Yes.
And, like, they clocked it immediately.
And like, this is, like, Jen's own best friend is a black woman who's saying, this is where she's saying.
Understanding how much of those children's lives were staged and made into photo ops, I don't know that that moment was actually consensual for Devante. I don't know if he actually wanted to hug that cop.
He's being used as a prop. They
exactly.
all are. They're
yes.
all props.
And, like, we've got to get better. We as white people have got to get better at identifying that.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean?
Like,
we've
come
got.
On.
And, like, the world, I will say, like, Zarin is telling us, like, the world kind of turned on Jen, because I think a lot of people did see it. And all of a sudden, a lot of the stories were like, here's the backstory of that really kind of weird photo
right.
that everyone loved.
So when Jen's called out for it,
yeah.
she presents herself as, like, the big three. She's a savior, she's a martyr, and a victim all at once.
Yeah.
Which
but
is,
you
like,
don't
amazing.
Get it. So it's the problem is you're the problem.
You're the problem. You're the yeah. racist. And look at everything I'm doing for
right.
these people. What are you doing? What'd you do today? I'm raising six black kids. Like,
right.
that's what she's doing.
Yeah.
But Jen has to go private because everyone's just so mean. No, no, no. What's really happening is that people are starting to see her for who she is.
Yes.
She can't control the narrative anymore. This is very, very dangerous for her.
Remember, she did all that stuff already of, like, yanking the kids out of school. They don't have any
oh,
friends.
Yeah.
No one ever comes to the house. They have no relationship with their family. The only way that the people saw the family was online. And now that's getting too scary because people are now looking into it.
Right. So she has to start a new narrative, and everyone, we're going to 2016, and we're going into the highly competitive gaming community.
This is wild.
Drew Bunch
yeah,
is
yeah.
here. Now, Jen, because she needs to be in control,
yeah.
and she needs to be, like, the leader, she starts playing a game. I had to Google what the game was. It's called Oz Broken Kingdom.
Ooh.
They were the second-ranked team in the world.
In the world!
Like, Jen's team, because, like, fuck you, Jen.
I know.
Honestly. But she was, like, Jen was the co-leader of this 50-person
yeah.
team.
Yes. And, like, that's a major job.
Major. She had a gaming diary.
Yeah.
Like, she was keeping track of the scores. She was cross-referencing information and the numbers, calculating.
It's
like,
hours and hours and hours a day. Remember that mom who was having sex in the Costco parking lot instead of, like, making sure her kid didn't shoot up a school?
I was
going to
say, don't you have six kids you need to feed,
yeah,
you asshole?
But that's what we are told later, is that, like, she was awful to her kids except for when she wanted a picture. So, like, she's doing the photos and putting them on Facebook but spending all of her actual time in this gaming portal.
Because she got off social media because she was called out. So
yes.
she went to the gaming community because she needs to be praised and she needs to be in charge. And
apparently
to, like,
you can use, like, gaming software as, like, Facebook. Like, you can post pictures and stuff there too?
Because it's, like, a very big, like, social
okay.
community. So I guess depending on what platform you're using.
Yeah.
But it's a very, I mean, it's a 50-person team and they're all playing together and, like,
yeah.
Jen was in charge. So, yeah, she was able to, but, like, also at the same time, so she gets to be in charge and, like, run the show, but she also gets to be her big three, the savior,
yes.
martyr, victim all at once. So,
yeah.
like, she can do it all online
yeah.
and it's amazing.
And this is where we see, like, this is, like, that guy Drew is back and he's saying, I saw all the pictures of them moving to the new house and the kids are playing with chickens and the kids are helping.
The gamers have no idea.
The gamers have no idea because also, like, the gamers are just all over the world. No one's ever going to meet Jen in real life.
Right. You can,
you know?
She can, yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So this was perfect for her.
Yeah.
So now we're back to this 911 call that we got at the top of the episode.
Right.
And we learned this was 6 months before the crash. And there's a guy saying,
yeah, there's some kids that I feel is being highly abused. The other night, a little girl jumped out of the second story window on the roof and then down onto the ground and ran to my daughter. And this is like 2 a.m, begging them to help her.
Begging for help.
Now, one other thing to point out I was noticing is that when you see aerial photos of this house, Jen moved them to as much of the middle of the woods as possible.
Mm-hmm.
They have a neighbor, but it's kind of the only neighbor, and they're very, very isolated. But thank God this neighbor is, like, kind of close by.
Right. So the girl is Hannah Hart,
yeah.
and she's saying to the neighbors, oh my God, she's saying, please take me away. They're racist. They're abusive. Like, please, please
take
help me
to Seattle. Don't make me go back there. Like,
yeah.
they're racist and abusive. Like, what is going on over there?
So the neighbor,
by the way, this is 2 a.m.
Yeah. So the Harts are obviously, like, looking for Hannah.
They hear them outside at, like, 2 a.m. looking for her.
And so now everyone is together.
Mm-hmm.
And the neighbors say today, like, Sarah never spoke, Jen did all the talking. And if you remember, Sarah was the one who has the conviction. And
yes.
Sarah's, who people are saying are like, she's definitely complicit, but she also might have been abused by Jen too. We will never know that.
Right.
But Sarah is definitely not helping these kids or saving them and whatever.
Yeah.
So Jen is saying, oh my God, Hannah has issues. Quote, she's a drug baby.
Uh-huh.
It's been a hard week.
And I'm like, are you saying that in front of her? Probably.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Because don't you fucking know how lucky you are to be here, Hannah?
Right. Yeah.
No one else would take you. You're a nightmare.
Yeah.
Be grateful that you're even here and know you can't have any more food. I mean, that's how it works.
Yeah.
So now these neighbors were all ready to go to the police, but Jen's bullshit worked. And they're sitting here and she's like, she
I don't
was really
know
convincing.
About that. Like,
I don't either.
You know what I mean?
So by 6 a.m., just a few hours later, Hannah comes back to the neighbor's house.
Yeah.
She has a handwritten apology and it says, Dear Dana Bruce, I stopped. And also, this does not, it looks like an adult wrote this, trying to look like a child's handwriting.
Yeah.
I stopped this morning because I feel awful about disturbing your peace. Does that sound like a child to you?
No.
And worrying you in the middle of the night. I was very frustrated with my brother and I didn't handle things very maturely. And I'm sorry for telling lies to get attention. I'm working on being more honest and finding a better way to communicate my frustrations. I've been very sad about two of our cats dying recently. So I'm just very sad and frustrated. Thank you for being kind, Hannah.
Like
no.
I mean, what she told them is the truth. And so the psychological toll that it took on that girl, that letter was dictated to her. No question.
No question. And if she even wrote it at all. If that's her handwriting, which I don't think it is.
Yeah.
It was dictated. No, I'm sorry for disturbing your peace. I was just so frustrated.
Uh-huh.
What kid talks like that?
Right, exactly.
Give me a break.
No.
So now Dana, the neighbor.
Before they left, I asked if I could have a word with just Hannah, and they said, no, we do everything as a family.
We do everything as a family. Anything that Hannah can say in front of you, she can say in front of us.
Which, again, is just such a major red flag. You know what I mean?
And so, like, of course they weren't going to let Hannah speak to them.
Right.
And I'm sitting here thinking, you should have just called the cops. And then I stopped. And I was like, we don't live in a time where you can just call the cops, especially when it's the word of two white women and six black kids. You cannot just call the cops.
No, but there are other agencies you can call. You know
and,
what I mean?
I hate that that's where we are, but this is, like, you can't just, like, call the cops.
But the cops aren't even the, like, I understand if you're just like a lay person, you're not going to know this, but the cops aren't even the right person to call anyway. It's like the Department of Children's Youth Services. Like, that's who you call.
I guess,
you know.
I mean, we can add it to the list of how many times this was called. They're already under investigation. One of them has been convicted. Like, what does it take?
But it's also like, you know, I'm not letting anybody off the hook here, but like, there's also only so much you can do. You know what I mean? If you're the neighbors, call somebody. If the cops are all you can think of to call, call the cops. But then what are you supposed to do? Like, pack the kids up in your like van and take them away in the middle of the night? You know what I mean? Our systems should work. Our cops should be able to be trained enough to see, or at least like, if a kid is escaping out a window at 2 a.m. and saying like they're racist and they're abusing me, like we should believe that kid.
With the bruises and
you
with
know?
All the records
yes.
and all the files and the conviction and like, can we just do
yes.
a little better, please?
And
a lot better?
That's what I'm saying is that we have to start teaching our people in power to unlearn the racist things that they've been taught.
Yeah.
We have to teach them to question white women. We have to teach them to look at a black kid and take them seriously. And there's got to be a way we can start to do that.
Yeah. I fucking, whatever. So Drew the Gamer was like, Jen was the best. Except when you violated one of her rules. And usually, funnily enough, those rules weren't actually spoken rules.
Right.
They were just what Jen wanted.
You
and if you didn't read her mind, then she'd like go nuts on you online. So like, but she would do this in her life. So for example, Sarah, the other one.
Yeah, Sarah the wife.
Was at work at Kohl's. And she gets this urgent phone call. And she's like, shit. And coworker Cheryl is like, girl, what's wrong? Like, are you okay? Now, Sarah apparently forgot to go online and play the game that they were all playing.
In the middle of her manager shift at Kohl's.
Right. And Jen, and she was like, oh, Jen, like, I can't, you know, like, clean up on aisle, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
She said that Jen was very upset with her. To the point that Jen had said, if Sarah wasn't going to support her, she might as well just kill herself. Because it was all she had to look forward to was this game.
All I have is this game, and if you're not going to help me, and if you don't love me, and if you're not supportive, and I'm like, what about your six hungry children? Can
right.
we give a shit about them?
No.
Or is it just about your game? Because that's the thing she can control.
And Cheryl's just saying, like, Sarah was always taking care of Jen. It was her job to calm Jen down. And she said, she's got this great line, Cheryl. She goes, I think Sarah was the buffer between the kids and Jen, like a battered spouse would be. Yeah.
So This is where it gets even more fucking frustrating, because March 2018, 10 days before the crash, Devante goes over to that same neighbor's house and asks for food. And he's asking at night, and then he'd ask a few hours later in the morning.
Now, the neighbor here says, I didn't think anything of it when he asked me the first time. I'm like, girl.
What about Hannah?
Right.
What about everything else?
Like a week ago, the young girl was saying she was getting beaten and they're racist, and now the other kid's asking for. She gave him 30 tortillas. Devante comes back over.
Because Devante would write her a list.
A list of food. 6 jars of peanut butter they
wanted. And ask the neighbors to leave it by the fence so that he could sneak over when no one's looking and get it. And you're thinking, what? This isn't like a cute little game we're playing.
And they say this was happening 2 to 3 times a day, every single day for 9 days.
6 months ago, Hannah was doing the same thing. And now Devante's like, well, I don't understand. I don't understand.
I really don't understand either.
And Devante kept going over there. And every time he went, he'd give more information about what's going on. And that's how we learned that there was a fridge full of food. Just like the Turpins, and the kids wouldn't eat for days at a time.
Yep.
And Devante makes these trips every day for 9 days. And every single day for 9 days, Jen is posting on Facebook for attention about how amazing she is.
I am a better human in every possible way for knowing these children. They have been my greatest teachers. I couldn't be more in awe of all the people that chose to celebrate this life with us. The thousands of people that have shared a hug, a dance, a story, a laugh, a meal, a cry, a word of encouragement, a smile, a song. Thank you for exemplifying the true meaning of family.
It's Zarin who tells us this, and it's such a glaring juxtaposition because it's like, it's so obvious that she does not care about her kids. She does not love her kids. She is using these children, starving them while writing these posts about how beautiful their life is.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
But now we get, like, it's documented that from March 15th to March 23rd, Devante begs Dana, the neighbor, for food 2 to 3 times a day. At what point,
I know,
do you do something or fucking walk over there yourself and kick the door in and say, what are you doing to these kids?
And also, he tells them, by the way, everything Hannah told you was true.
Like, Dana, I know, I'm glad, thanks for being here and telling your story, and I'm glad we're like getting the truth about these women, but like, I'm asking like all of us, at what point is it March 16th? 17th, 18th, all the way to the 23rd, 2 to 3 times a day, you're just doing nothing? You're just like, you know, you have like a sick feeling in your stomach about these poor kids. Don't you just go over there and do something?
And it's hard because we always do that thing where it's like,
Am I crazy for asking that?
No, you're not. But it's like, you know, we always say like the only killer is the killer, right? You know?
I know that.
But I can't get into the mindset.
He's begging for food 3 times a day for 9 days.
And it's also eventually her father who calls 911, not her.
And you don't, and I don't, I'm asking like, and you're not even just saying like, oh, here's this tuna sandwich.
Yeah.
You're doing what he wants, which is hiding it by the fence so he can get it safely. And like, it's not.
And like, maybe like, I sometimes get in trouble for making quote excuses for the bad guys. Maybe she's thinking, I'm just going to be the one who gives them food. You know what I mean? Like, maybe she's thinking like, I will be like, I'm giving Devante the shopping list every day and the kids are getting fed. I don't know. I don't know.
I'm at the end of my fucking rope because it's been years of this abuse, documented abuse, the bruises on the kids, the fucking conviction, the neighbors for 9 days, 3 times a day.
I know. And you know, we'll understand in the end that it's like they move from state to state to state because that's how they, like, there is no national database for child abuse.
Right.
So they can't be tracked from state to state.
I feel crazy. I feel like I'm not.
I know.
I must be missing something here. Like, what am I getting wrong?
No, it's the sad truth is that everybody failed these kids. That's it. You know what I mean? But the point is, we can learn. You know what I mean? Like, we can do better.
I really hope so. I'm feeling despondent about it, if I'm being honest with you. I'm feeling like, well, when?
I know.
When?
I know.
Because in 2 months, we're going to have another documentary to cover like this, Patrick. Mm-hmm. And it makes me crazy. So when, this is in 2018, like, when does it start? You know what? I'm feeling like.
Yeah, I know.
Like,
I know.
I don't.
It's like you can see the van going over the cliff in your brain, and it's like, what can we do to stop it? Yeah.
You know?
I know.
So finally, on March 23rd, the 911 call happens, and the Harts flee in 10 hours.
Yeah.
10 hours later, they're gone.
Yeah.
So on May 9th, 2018, the cops find Hannah's remains.
And they say after finding Hannah's remains, like, we just understood that Devante had been claimed by the ocean. Like, no amount of searching is going to find him. He's been taken away that way.
Yeah. Now, Sheriff Tom has had this case the whole time.
Yeah.
And he makes it a point to make sure that this is not documented as an accident.
He said, you know, from the beginning, I didn't want to make any judgments. He said, I didn't want history to judge us as an accident if it wasn't, and I didn't want history to judge us as a crime if it wasn't.
Right.
So he does this thing where he decides to do a coroner's inquest because he's the sheriff, but also the coroner.
Yeah.
And so basically what they do, like a year and a week to the day after the crash, they put all of the evidence to a jury and they let the jury decide. It's like a real trial.
It's like a criminal case.
Yeah.
And so the jury comes back and they have decided that the children were murdered and the moms killed the children and themselves.
And with respect to Abigail Hart, Marcus Hart, Jeremiah Hart, Sierra Hart, Hannah Hart, Devante Hart, the finding is at the hands of another other than by accident.
In the end, we're just left with, like, how did this happen, you know?
Yeah. Like, you know, like we've been saying, like you just said, like, so many people failed these kids, like,
every investigation
of
the parents ends with, quote, insufficient evidence. And somebody says, like, what evidence do you need to know that these kids needed help? The whole idea that there is no national database where, like, maybe we could have caught them as they're moving.
For child abuse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, all of these things that were documented, it's not like, you know, like, the one school in one state has these papers. But it's like that jurisdiction frustration that we have all the time where it's like, oh, the cops aren't talking to each other. Like, can we just make sure, especially if people just keep adopting more kids, can you just make 100% sure that it's a safe place?
And I just don't think you can care too much. I don't think that you can call the police too many times when the kids are telling you that they're being abused.
I know.
You know?
And I also think it's shitty that you can't, we don't live in a time where it's like, call the cops, they'll help.
Uh-huh.
Like, we don't live in that world anymore, especially when it's white women against the six black kids.
But so,
like,
maybe that's what the neighbor was thinking. You know what I mean? And like, she's just going to buy the six jars of peanut butter every day. Nobody thinks that anybody's going to put six kids in a van and drive them over
it's
a cliff.
Yeah, maybe. You know? Maybe. And she didn't say it here, so if this is true, I don't know, because they didn't play this part of the interview, but maybe she thought, if there's anything I can do, I can feed them.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Girl, I don't know. That one was really hard.
It's really hard. We gotta fucking do better.
I know.
God damn it.
Well, speaking of doing a little bit better, one thing to look forward to, fam. If you are on the page of the 5 or above, Drag Bingo, September 6th, 7 o'clock with the Amazing Swa.
It's a really good outlet. It's a really good, like, therapeutic night. We're all together. The playlist is awesome. Swa is awesome. The prizes are great. Like, it's just a way to come together.
We really need something happy to focus on right now.
And just, like, togetherness and just people trying to put good in the world. Because God, we need it. Like, real good. Not like fake curated bullshit filtered Instagram.
Totally. Bullshit. Here's something else, fam. If, in case you haven't, like, thought about this in a while, go to your podcast app and make sure that you're subscribed to True Crime Obsessed.
Oh, great. Okay.
Or that you're following the show. So if you're an Apple Podcast or Spotify, just go follow the show. That way you know you're going to get it every single week when it comes out. You don't have to search for it.
Oh, great. Okay,
That's
good.
A new thing I think that we should remind people to do. You just hit that little plus sign and then all of a sudden we're yours forever.
Great. Easy peasy.
Girl, what are we doing next?
Okay, we're doing How to Rob a Bank on Netflix.
Yes.
We're going to Seattle in the 90s, everyone. Start blasting that Pearl Jam and Soundgarden. We're going.
Good. We need, not that a bank robbery is a victimless crime, but we need something that's not kids going over a cliff.
There's a really cool treehouse.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I love that.
And again, 1990 Seattle. Soundtrack. I mean, come on.
I know. Soundtrack of a generation.
We love it.
Oh my God. All right. Well, stay tuned for the trailer for that, fam. And maybe funny and hilarious outtakes. So I got to be honest, I doubt it this week.
I don't know. Ragey outtakes, are those a thing?
maybe we should make them a thing. Ragey outtakes, that's my drag name.
TM.
All right, fam, we love you.
We love you.
Bye.
This is a robbery.
He was the most prolific bank robber in the Pacific Northwest.
He's robbed 14 banks in Seattle since June of 1992.
This case was spinning a little bit out of control.
He was a smart bank robber. He became our number one priority.
What happened here reads straight from a movie script.
His moniker was Hollywood.
He wears heavy makeup, a wig.
His co-star is this 9mm handgun.
Everyone on the floor!
He said, man, this is the easiest thing. It's like taking candy from kids. And I just thought, this is insane.
Steal from the rich and give to the poor. How noble is that?
People talk about Robin Hood, but in terms of who Hollywood was, we couldn't have been more wrong.
I'm going on record. These are the world's only two bad lesbians.
Well,
unless that one that broke up with you that time, ma'am, she also sucks.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But other than that one, these two.
Okay.
They're the only bad ones.
They're just like, they just don't. I mean.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I know. But other than that, lesbians are going to save us.
Okay.